Good afternoon. We'd like to get started on time. We're broadcasting this lecture today, and we are committed to keeping this on time so that people can get back to work on time afterwards. I'd like to welcome you all to this campus community lunch and learn featuring our own campus community volunteer, as well as McGill professor David Kopo, who speak for us today about McGill's treasures in architecture. All kinds of interesting treasures, as I understand. My name is Robin Wiltshire, and I'm one of the co-chairs of the Campus Community Committee, with my fellow co-chairs, Peter Knox, representing McDonald Campus, SFMU President Zach Newberg, who represents our students, and, of course, a man who needs no introduction, our former Vice Principal of Admin Finance, Morty Olotsky. We are responsible for the co-chairs of a large volunteer committee that spans the whole campus. And before turning over to Morty, who will introduce David, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the campus community. My introducing Morty, who introduces David, is really a McGill tradition. We like to have people introduce people who will introduce people at most of our events, in case you hadn't noticed. So the campus community committee came together a couple of years ago, and our objective really is to engage our faculty and staff, and building on a strong relationship of a foundation, really, of collegiality. We're working to forge even greater bonds between all of the members of McGill's community, and one of the ways we do that is by hosting events and bringing people together. Our volunteer committee is made up from volunteers across campus, and we'd love to have a representative from your unit. So if anyone would like to join the Campus Community Committee, please just get in touch with me, send me an email message, and we'll tell you how you can join us and all of the work we're doing, and where you might make a contribution. What volunteers are, what unites our volunteers is really to see McGill reach its full potential and anything that we can do to support that. So our events, as I said, provide opportunities for social interaction between faculty and staff from all over our campus. These lunch and learns help us to learn more about the research being done by our faculty members. We've named the month of July our Rediscover McGill Month, and we're featuring events. We had a treasure hunt earlier a couple of weeks ago, which was a lot of fun. Today's lecture about the campus itself. Next Tuesday, there are guided tours of the Red Path Museum. Anyone who hasn't visited the Red Path ever or recently is encouraged to take part in that. And then on November 2nd, we're hosting an event called Artists Among Us, which is an art exhibition and sale of McGill artists that's taking place in the music building. You can find out about all of these events on our website. So we'll be caroling in December. There's a reading of Dickens' A Christmas Carol taking place also. And again this year, we'll be hosting the Magic of Chemistry show for McGill faculty and staff to bring their families out to this event close to the holiday time. In January, Richard Kessner will give a lunch and learn to tell us about his research on commitment and to help tell us how maybe we can keep our own New Year's resolutions and what he's found in his research that might support that. So just before turning over to Morty, David will take questions throughout his talk today. So if you'd like to get his attention to ask your question, and then just make sure you have your microphone turned on, the microphone in front of you turned on, so that they'll pick up your question in addition to the answer on our broadcast, which is going out to the rest of the people on campus who couldn't make it to join us today. Morty, thanks.
Thank you, Robin. As I glance at the audience, I realize that most people here probably do know David, and most of them have worked with David. David's been a member of the faculty at McGill since 1978. He served as director of the School of Architecture for a period of 9 years, the late 90s to the 2007. David is certainly well known for the work that he's done with respect to the campus development plan. If one were to talk about McGill as an international university, and our faculty members, our students come from all over, our faculty members come from all over, but as well we're involved in international projects, I can only tell you that David best embodies this, because he's involved in projects in Pakistan, in Mexico, in China, in Romania, and more recently in Singapore and South Korea. Now, I may have forgotten some countries, but certainly David's been very active. He was elected as member of the Fellow of the Royal Architect Institute of Canada. He serves as the president of the Canadian Architectural Certification Board. And within McGill, he chairs what is called the Architectural Advisory Committee, which is, in fact, the body that needs to go ahead and approve the construction of new buildings within the university. And one of the challenges that David and his committee go ahead and face is the fact that in some universities they have what I would call a uniform architectural plan, that if you look at the buildings, they all look very, very similar, almost cookie cutter to each other. McGill has never had that type of policy, and therefore every time you get a new building, you get a new architect who wants to sort of wow the world, and it's up to the Architectural Advisory Committee to allow them to wow the world, but yet to fit into the structure that we have. Probably his best achievement, in my mind, is he was responsible for Redpath Beach. Now, those of you who do not know what Redpath Beach is, maybe David will comment on it. In 2001, we established the Redpath Beach, which is really the grassy area just in front of the Redpath Library, which from being a very high slope becomes a very sort of flat slope. And when the sun is out, that's where all the students can be found. David, the show is yours.
Thank you, Morty. Thank you very much, Robin. And thanks to all of you who've taken the time to come here today. I must apologize in advance. I see a number of people who attended a presentation I gave at the management forum about a year ago. You will see some overlap between today's presentation and that presentation last year. And John, the presentation that I did for your group, Learning in Retirement, a few years ago, also included some of the ideas that I would like to put in front of you this afternoon. It's supposed to be lunch and learn, but I see that nobody's lunching. I'm hoping that it maybe will make up for the lack of lunch with a little extra learning. Morty was very kind in his introduction. I have to say, with respect to Redpath Beach, and you will see some images of Redpath Beach in summer and winter, that was the product of an ad hoc group discussion that included three or four people, maybe even more, as we walked across the campus one day. But I'll say more about that later and maybe at the end if there's questions. Most of what I'm going to talk about, I think it's fair to say, is related partly to some of the work I do for the university in architectural advisory, and many of our colleagues from facilities management and development and the planning officer here today, and even some of the architects that Morty referred to as enjoying opportunities to wow the public when they get an opportunity to work on campus. Many different venues, not the least of which was Doonesbury by Gary Trudeau, who picked up on a theme that you see here. What's the deal of that building? Pretty cool. It's the Status Center, but everybody calls it Building 32. Supposedly, the Cambridge cops use it as a sobriety test. How so? If it appears normal, you're drunk. Everybody has an opinion. And again, don't forget that this building, which you see here, which is actually a profoundly interesting building, it has direct technical issues, apparently, with what else? Leaking and water infiltration in a variety of places, presumably. But at its core, it is a fundamentally successful building in the way that it integrates the program of the faculty and the departments that occupy it within the fabric of the university. What we're seeing here is an image, and there another one, of the interior street that actually connects one part of the campus to the other through the building. And I'll come back to this in a few minutes. Some countries, unfortunately Canada's not one, still put architects on their paper currency. There's a secret campaign to get Moshe Safdie on the 20 and Arthur Erickson on the 50, but don't hold your breath. We're dealing with a very conservative infrastructure at the Mint. This is Switzerland, of course, and the architect being celebrated here on the 10-franc note is Le Corbusier, Swiss-born, but generally regarded as a French architect and someone who practiced also internationally. The 10-franc note celebrates his work and his research. He visited the States several times, but in the 30s and 40s. He wrote this in 1947. He said, each college or university is an urban unit. This is a European exploring what was seen at that time as a kind of land, a territory filled with opportunity. Each college is an urban unit, a small or large city, but a green city, lawns, parks, stadiums, cloisters, dining halls, a whole complex of comfortable quarters. He says, Morty is smiling at this, there is an abundance of money. A millionaire, or the widow of a millionaire, or the widower these days, gladly wills a fortune to the men's or women's college where they were so happy at 20. The American university, he says, is a world in itself, a temporary paradise. Who could argue with that? Here's an image of a world in itself, a temporary paradise, executed in watercolor by the late, great Percy Nobbs, former director of the School of Architecture, and an architect responsible for much of what all of us would agree constitutes the heritage backbone, or the architectural heritage of this campus. This is 1925, and I think you can see clearly what's going on there. And it is, to some extent, an idealized vision, but it also reflects fairly accurately what was going on. Nobbs was responsible for a number of projects that were never built, as well as projects that were built. And I don't have time today to talk about those, but maybe some other, there will be other opportunities. At the same time as the watercolor was built, this is what the campus looked like. This is from Ritual McGill, or probably the Nutman Archives. It's about 1925, and you can see here the original Redpath Library, including the addition by Percy Nobbs in 1921. And over here, the engineering building, also designed by Nobbs. I'll say something about that in a few minutes. About 30 years later, that's what the campus looked like. You see the Redpath Library addition here, 1952, 1953. The Max Welton, where I lived for 3 years, is also there. The Roddick Gates are in place, as they were in the last image as well. The reservoir is up there, and of course, it's covered. 30 years later, this is an aerial view photograph taken, this is courtesy of Red Dujester in the planning office. This is from a series of images taken from an airplane in 2006, 2007, maybe 2008. So it's about 30 years, 32 years after the last image, describing the campus that we now know, with the exception, of course, and coincidentally, there are no cars in this image. That photograph was taken at a time when you had to come here on Christmas Day, or car-free day, or before 6 in the morning, when the only car on campus might have been Jim Nysel's, and only if he happened to drive to work that day, as opposed to bike or use public transit. And of course, all of you know that the car, or that the campus, is now campus-free. The cars are campus-free. The campus is also car-free, or at least parking-free. And I don't know if we'll have time at the end, but I'll try to reserve a little time at the end to talk about some of the issues which are engaging on a weekly basis now, a working group, focusing on the implications of the launch on May 28th of this year of McTavish Street as a pedestrian zone and the campus as a pedestrian zone. There's a long and very interesting list of design issues that have arisen and that preoccupy, as we speak, a working group of some 20 or 25 people from across the campus. There we are from the air. Some of you know the Sim series, Sim City. It's a computer game, a simulation. I was very surprised to see. I rarely surf on the web, but came across this somehow, and I was struck by the correspondence between a campus, between our campus, and once again the idealized version of Sim State University, which is a part of the community associated with. This series of simulation games, including the kind of the iconic building at the top of the main axis, an intersection, which is the subject of fairly intense scrutiny now, and something that looks suspiciously in the perspective like the Roddick Gates, but which in fact is simpler. Let's not forget that we have two campuses. The main campus here, and at the same scale as this photograph, courtesy of Google, the McDonald College campus. Some of you may know the campus. We think of the campus, of course, as this area here, and these two images are at the same scale. We think of the campus here, of course, but in fact, that's John Abbott, with the exception of Britton Hall here and Glen Allendale House, which is down there. Our campus is basically restricted to this side here and, of course, everything along the water. I wish I had more time to talk about this, but I will refer to a few issues arising there. In the physical master plan recently completed by Diamond Schmidt and Detroit Alsop Hillier and other consultants, this was the plan that started in 2005, was approved in 2008. One of the documents they included was this very interesting drawing that simply superimposes the downtown campus in black on the McDonald campus, expressed in outline alone. That master plan, let's keep in mind as well, that image here of the campus is here, and that the McDonald campus domain includes all of this, as well as all of this up there, just to give you a sense of the size of these things. The downtown campus measures something like 36 hectares, in contrast to the 650 that the university maintains out at the west, on the western tip of the island. This, for many of us, remains the symbol of the McDonald campus, but of course now that's part of John Abbott. This is a plan from the Diamond Schmidt document that describes the entire precinct. And it's interesting to compare this to the demonstration plan that they included as an expression, really, of intention. There's no intent here to describe what the campus will look like. What's being expressed in this drawing is the importance of developing, and I'll go back to this drawing here. This is what we see as the campus of McDonald College. It's John Abbott. We are shifting towards the east, and what the Diamond Schmidt demonstration plan says here, essentially, is that we must think of this as a kind of a campus with two centers, something here and something over there, and that these can operate in some complementary way in design terms, I think is a very powerful and very exciting idea. As some of you know, there is a building under construction now on the John Abbott campus, a new building, a new science building for John Abbott by Saussure & Perrott Architects, who've done quite a bit of work on this campus. A couple of images. That's a sketch by one of the partners, either Gilles Saussure or André Perrott, describing the main intention. Here is the iconic building that you saw a minute ago in the slide. And the idea that their new building on this site can restore some notion of symmetry to the classical quadrangle, or the classical green, provides a foundation for what became an interesting discussion about the building itself. The plan will surprise you, as well as some of the images. These are images from a computer model. The building is, I think, is it under construction as we speak? I'm not sure about that. But let's get back to this interior view of one of the building's main circulation spaces. I will come back to this idea later on in this presentation. Let's get back to the basics. This is where it all started. I don't know what the year is, possibly 1812, the turn of the 19th century. Presumably McGill's farm, or at least a part of it. I include this image from that same series of aerial photographs that came from the planning office to dramatize an idea that we talk about a lot but may not really appreciate, which is the notion that the campus, which is here, could be seen as a kind of mediating environment. We always talk about the way in which the campus, or how important it is that the campus mediate between the city and Mount Royal. But this image, it seems to me, expresses that beautifully. And we see the edge of the mountain here, and the Belvedere, the park here, the stadium, the reservoir, the RBH here in Ravenscrag, and you have this continuous, it's a virtually continuous carpet of green from the summit of the mountain across the reservoir through the campus. And I think the city uses the campus in this way. We'll come back to this later. In 1843, it's the date most people refer to, this building, the center portion, opened for classes. It had been under construction for a few years. In 1846, 3 or 4 years later, the university realized they had no money for teachers or chalk or books, and they sold off the land below Sherbrooke Street. In retrospect, that seems like a bad idea, but you never know. We're in no position to make those kinds of judgments. They did what they had to do. But it's interesting now to look at the plan of Montreal and to imagine what the downtown core would be like with McGill still operating that space below Sherbrooke Street. What was interesting at the time was that the university went back to John Ostell, the architect of this building, to do the subdivision in preparation for the sale of those properties below Sherbrooke Street. And he discovered as he drew the plan that if he shifted McGill College a little bit, it would line up exactly on the dome of the building that he had just completed 3 or 4 years earlier for the university. Now that, the history of that alignment has changed over time, and if you come up McGill College now, what you'll find is that when you walk up the east sidewalk of McGill College and stay close to the edge, be careful, traffic goes fairly fast from time to time, and it's not car-free yet. But if you walk up the edge on that east sidewalk, you will find yourself, when you come to Sherbrooke, exactly on line with the Arts Building through the center of the Roddick Gate. The little building on the right, some of you may know, most of you may know, was at that time the principal's residence. And over time, Ostell added the Molson wing and then a first story and then a second story to configure the building that we now recognize as the Arts Building. But in fact, it appeared what seems so coherent to us now as an architectural assembly was in fact the result of a combination of additions and restorations and renovations over many, 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 many years. That's my car. The good old days when we could park on campus. I don't mean that, Jim. It's okay. I like the car-free campus. The east side of the campus is where I work in that office, and much of what you're going to see in the next few images was photographed from that window. Not a lot of change in the 100 years between those two photographs. There is one significant change. Does anyone get it? Apart from all the material and stuff in the background, trees for sure, always. You're going to see trees going up and down, trees transforming from little saplings to great elms in the course of the presentation. There's a significant change here. This building here is not the building that's there now. This building was the engineering built by the same architect that did the McDonald Harrington building, Andrew Taylor and partners. Built in 1892, 1893, and burned down in 1907. Just to bring us back to why we're here, that's the building. Designed by Taylor in 1892, 93. Destroyed by fire. This image is from a 1908 university calendar, which you'll see in a second. That's the building that Percy Nobbs built, opened in 1908 to replace the previous engineering building. Designed or presented at the time as fireproof in response to the series of events that destroyed not just the engineering building, but also the medical building. And you'll see that in a second. Nobbs, as an architect, was extremely accomplished and enjoyed introducing into his architecture the kind of references that some of you may recognize. And in this case, what he did here was place this bas-relief, which describes the phoenix rising out of the ashes with the date of the fire inscribed on top. So for Nobbs, this was his device, the instrument he uses to explain why his building is there and to record, to give the whole exercise a little bit of memory and meaning. The page from the calendar that I referred to before describes the McDonald Engineering Building burning, destroyed by fire, April 5, 1907, originally erected by Sir William McDonald in 1893, is being rebuilt upon the same site and considerably enlarged. The medical building, destroyed by fire 2 weeks later, less than 2 weeks later, April 5th, April 16th, just around the corner. Originally erected in 1872, enlarged in 1901, will be rebuilt on Pine Avenue in Carlton Road near the Royal Victoria Hospital. That was moved to what is now the Strathcona Anatomy and Dentistry Building. And the administration building now stands on the site of this building. I didn't include the whole calendar. Above this, on this page of the calendar, is a reference, a photograph of the Arts Building, and I love this. The center building opened in 1829. I said 1843. We'll figure out later who's right. The other portions added at various times. Total value in 1908, $100,000. I think that building now has furniture. Pieces of furniture probably worth more than $100,000. Contains the offices of the university, labs, botanical, zoological departments, and lecture rooms for both arts and law. That's the medical building that was destroyed at about the same time in 1907. That's the building that replaced it. You see the difference between this building and the building that we now recognize as James? This appeared about 20 years later, I think. The architects were Ross and McDonald, who celebrated their centennial, actually, in 2004. This, of course, is no longer there, the little conservatory. It was essentially a biology building, which is why there's a little stone frog at the top of the crest, keeping an eye on James Square. The other, what's that? One floor missing, absolutely. Sometime later, I think in the 50s or 60s, a sixth floor was added. But the building actually fairly nicely recomposed or reconfigured to accept it. Back to McDonald Harrington on the east side of the campus. My point of view, it's always interesting. I collect one of the areas of less formal research in which I'm interested is related to children's drawings. I'm interested in how children describe their experience and express their ideas about the world. And I suggest to my own students that we have a lot to learn. They have a lot to learn. If they only went back to the file somewhere in their family's archives where their mother keeps all the drawings that used to be pinned up to the fridge or taped up to the fridge, take those drawings and look at them again, and they'll learn something about how they should be drawing now. This drawing was executed by Charlie Krawitz, the son of the administrative coordinator in the School of Architecture, who, did you want to say something? No, we don't have time. David asked his son to, I guess, was it your idea or was it Charlie's idea? His. He's going to make a picture of where Dad worked. So this is his expression of the McDonald Harrington building. It's full of information. You know, kids are less concerned with what they see. They want to tell us really what they know. So naturally, there's clouds. The sun is shining. The campus referred to here, that's the Rodic Gates. He couldn't see them, of course, from there, but they had to be there somewhere because he came through them to get there. We see the main facade. There's a notion of a hip roof up there, dormer windows, even a notion of fenestration. It's a little confused, but not a lot more confused than most of us might produce under pressure. And the annex on the side. And what's especially interesting is to compare the basic ideas that you find here and the ideas that Charlie, as a child of 4 or 5 or 6. Finds important. Especially interesting to me, as a former director of a School of Architecture and the Faculty of Engineering, was to try to figure out what this was here. And of course, when Charlie was challenged, he said, well, that's this building here. That's the Faculty of Engineering. So, out of the mouths of babes, is one idea that occurs to me, and another thought is that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Let's go to the west side of the campus. A scene that really hasn't changed very much at all. 1893, same architect, Bedford Library, as McDonald Harrington, and the original engineering building, and the physics building. Morris Hall, 1881, 1882, but only acquired by the university, I think, in 1961. And just peeking behind, you see a little bit of the presbytery, which was demolished to make way for the Leacock building in the early 60s, and of course Redpath Museum, 1881, 1882, about the same time as Morris Hall. This is one part of their view from my campus, or part of the view of the campus from my window, and it's given me an interesting opportunity to see the change being affected behind, but also to look at this. That's Redpath Beach. Morty referred to that earlier. A rare image in the spring of students migrating to that one sliver of sunlight on a cold spring afternoon. I don't know if you can appreciate that. In the winter, of course, the same view, one that we take for granted. One of the ideas we're looking at now in this working group, looking at the campus, is the winter campus. We're trying to redefine it in ways that some of us might remember from the 60s and 70s. This image, taken from my office window, 3 weeks before this image was taken. So, again, nobody is more versatile with respect to how they occupy the campus than our students. And there might be a couple of philosophy professors there, too. But but I'm not so sure. The next image of Redpath Beach. And there's that sliver. And of course, as the sun moved, you could slowly see people picking up their bags and trying to stay in that shaft of sunlight. This is a reminder of the extent to which our precinct, the precinct that we cherish, is defined by what you could characterize as unrestrained growth. It reinforces, I think, a very important issue for all of those in the room focused on the physical maintenance and development of the university. Space is at a premium. And as we move up the west side of the campus to this image of the mountain and McIntyre and a crane that disappeared a couple of years ago, it brings us to the first of several projects that I want to look at in a little more detail that allow me to bring out some of these ideas and may elicit a few questions from you. It gives me an opportunity also to say something about this. The Leacock Building, I think one of the university's most successful modern buildings. Nobody in the room agrees with me, I don't think. Certainly nobody in facilities. Every year I look for someone who will agree that this is a great building. And in fact, I think it's a phenomenally successful building by Ray Affleck and Arkoff Associates. And how many of you appreciate what that would look like if they hadn't decided to mask all of the mechanical equipment associated with modern buildings behind a form that we recognize as operating in a kind of harmony with the roof of the Redpath Museum and the roof of the engineering building and the dome of the arts building and so on and so forth. Simple gesture, but evidence of a profoundly sophisticated understanding, not just of architectural design, but how you insert something in 1963 in a campus that started to grow 140 years earlier. But let's go up to McIntyre. There's the site. Diamond and Schmidt, Provencher-Edouard were the architects. 200,000 square feet, an impossibly large building. It was reduced by 20,000, increased by 20,000 again, back to the present figure of about 200,000 square feet in an impossibly constrained site. And to make, if it weren't enough that the site were between McIntyre and a precinct of heritage buildings and coach houses designed by the Maxwell brothers and landscaped by Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Mount Royal and Central Park and Prospect Park, clearly a heritage site, which sandwiched the building. If that were enough, we have biology here, law, the law precinct over here, and a parking garage on which a good chunk of the building actually sits. Very, very interesting building. The computer model, an image of one of the constraints, this heritage compound of private residences, all of which are now occupied by for university use. Not some teaching space, office space, research space, and some residential. Jim Nisel, in a recent presentation, said that the university manages something like 228 buildings on both campuses. Bob Stanley disagreed and said it's closer to 250. But you were a few weeks apart, I think, in your response to my question. Of the 228, I think you said that something like 60% are pre-1950, and something like 15% or 13% of the total space is pre-1900. The lesson there is that a significant proportion of the buildings and space we occupy is space that everyone would agree unanimously should be characterized as heritage architecture, which puts us in a very interesting position with respect to our relationship with the city, les amis de la montagne, and the people who actually pay for both the maintenance and construction of our properties. That's the building as it looks now from that same series of aerial photographs. You can see how delicately the Goodman and the Bellini have been, the two wings have been inserted. It's a very urban building in what was at one time a peri-urban context coming down from the mountain. The university's first large-scale experience with a green roof, which from some points of view extends the green carpet of the mountain. And, of course, here's the precinct developed according to a landscape designed by Olmsted and built to plans prepared by the Maxwells over a course of some decades. Two other heritage buildings, Hosmer here and Davis, both occupied by the School of Physical Occupational Therapy. And it reminds me that of that 228 buildings, something 35, 40, are in fact former residences, former residential buildings, houses and multifamily, now occupied by university space, or for university purposes, non-residential university purposes. Some views of Bellini, the right-of-way that existed there before, underneath what we call, what everyone calls the panhandle, but was preserved, of course. It's the main central link. Lab floors looking east. The nighttime view is marvelous. What's not so legible in the daytime becomes instantly legible at night. And it's interesting to see how in architectural environments like this, users begin to occupy and mark their territory. On Pine, of course, the building is very, very narrow. It's expressed as a bay projection, a bay window of a type. And what is surely one of the university's very best meeting rooms. How many of you have had a meeting in that room? It is a truly fantastic room, and everyone always sits. When I go, I'm always sitting with my back to the city, of course, because I see, you know, framed against it. Hard to concentrate because you have the mountain and the everything behind you. This, what I think is also a very successful intervention, and you'll see a number of images that refer to the so-called 1% program. Many of you have heard that expression before. You know that when the provincial government puts money into a project, the owner must spend a certain percentage of those funds on public art, and there is a whole process designed for this, competitive, designed for the selection of the artist and the implementation of the project itself. This was a very interesting piece, 12 or 13 meters tall, by an Abitibi-based artist named Luc Boyer. I think it's called Le Retour, and it's his impression or his interpretation of cancer as a disease and how the people who work in that building are actually fighting it. It's an intervention that has polarized more than one discussion between those of us who are involved in the process. That includes Michel Tremblay and Carmen Lampron. All of us love this piece, and a number of university officials. How many of you do you know the piece? Do we like it? Hands up, everyone who likes it. Okay. Hopefully that will change. It will get better with age, by the way. This is an opportunity to refer you back to a space that you walked through on your way here but may not have noticed. One of my favorite spaces in all the university, again by Arkoff and Ray Affleck, part of the Leacock complex. One of my favorite art pieces, Icarus by Catherine Widgery. I invite you to explore it when you go back outside. And outside, again by the same architects, this absolutely marvelous arcade that one would think is more of a, might be more of a recurring theme in university buildings. Affleck and Arkoff introduced it in 1963, 64 when they did Leacock. The idea appears and reappears from time to time with our modern buildings, and I'm sorry that we haven't been able to develop it more as one of the things that defines buildings on a precinct like a campus. We're going to move from there up to the stadium very, very quickly. This building, which you may have seen under construction, is the Brain Imaging Center. I won't say very much about this. LeMay Associates are completing it. Phil Bobrow started it. The interesting thing about this building is that it's two stories up and I think five stories down. Is that right, Bob? Two up, five down. It's a very, very constrained site. One of the most interesting excavations I think I've ever seen on campus. They encountered rock, I think, just a few inches below the surface. And in fact, the rock was an issue when it came time to replant. The negotiation with the city was for every tree that was removed, two were replaced. But what we found at one point that planting new trees in the thin layer of topsoil wasn't as easy as we thought it would be. That's the back of the building. Well, this is the Webster Pavilion here, the north stands of Molsa Stadium. And the site, of course, is back there where you see the crane. This stadium recently renovated, restored and renovated, I would say, and expanded by Willem and Gee and Associates. Mike Willem is here. Welcome, Mike. There's the site for the building there, and of course, it's just tucked in that corner right there. I want to say a few words about this. The idea here is to, again, try to give you some sense of how difficult it is to work on this campus at this stage. There was a time when architects who worked here were working, were developing or thinking about what they were doing as pavilions in a kind of park. The images from 1900 that you saw at the beginning of the lecture describe an environment like that. No such space exists now. Every space, every square inch has been occupied. There's very, very little site, very, very little opportunity. This was a project, a CFI application that goes back about, I think, almost 10 years, John. We were looking for something like 25,000 square feet as a part of the engineering complex. There had been a tendency over the years always to see Dame William McCurr with the architects. Design 21 was a proposal, 50,000 square feet, $25 million estimate. And there had been a tendency over the years to see the courtyard, a service courtyard behind the engineering buildings, as a kind of ideal space, but you can't do that. A huge proportion of the space needs the windows for light and even ventilation. And there are many other reasons that made it difficult to actually fill that void. It can't be done easily. So the architects came up with a very interesting proposal, which was to design the new building as a kind of a bridge that spanned from University Street to the campus, added a thin layer that would actually close the loop, the interior circulation loop around the engineering complex, and provide an access point to the whole complex on the campus. Very exciting idea. But the proposal wasn't accepted, and the thing will never be built. I want to go down to Music, southeast corner of the campus. It was the southeast corner of the campus until recently, but of course you know that the university has been acquiring property east on Sherbrooke Street, and there are now at least two buildings that are and will be operated as residences. But this building, when it was conceived, defined what was then the southeast corner of the campus. Associated with the architects, and they had the luxury of being invited to start a building in the mid-90s. Their practice was still fairly young. For lack of funding, the project was put on hold, and then four or five years later, the project was reactivated and the program expanded with additional funding and new research monies. So here was an opportunity for a young firm learning with every project, an opportunity to revisit a project that they had done, developed 5 or 6 years earlier, to revisit it and to refine in ways that I think are remarkable the ideas that their ways of thinking about many of the problems with which they were dealing at that time. The project itself, you know, RBC is here, Sherbrooke Street, Aylmer, there's the project. That was the earlier scheme that was revised, and this was a proposal they did for an opera center, which will never be built. Adjacent is Royal Victoria College. The designed, I think, in 1899, turn of the 19th century. Construction here, and then finally the new building, emerging behind Queen Victoria here, projecting onto Sherbrooke Street, expressing itself differently on different facades. This is an idea that we find more and more common in the last 10 years or so. So the Sherbrooke Street facade is not the same as the facade that greets anyone coming down Sherbrooke Street from the eastern side. And it's not. This is that close by that facade where we're seeing a base here, library here, and then various other occupancies on top. The building, when it was opened, included two floors that had not yet been developed, a new idea for the university, the notion that we can build a shell and then complete it when the funding becomes more available is actually has been a very successful idea. The building itself, the architects describe in interesting ways. That's a schematic cross-section. What you see here was what, for many architects, was a programmatic element that would be baffling. This was the requirement to build a space 5 stories tall, I know, 75 feet wide and over 100 feet long. It's a sound stage. Every time I go in there, I wait for someone to say, cue the elephants. It's a huge space. My students say, what's it for? And I said, well, we teach hang gliding in this room. You know, if you haven't been there, I encourage you, contact Bruce Minorgan, somebody, or someone. Is Bruce here? I thought I saw him come in earlier. No? And they will give you a tour. But for the architects, it became an element around which many of the ideas of the building became organized. There you see a cross-section through the model. So a lobby here, a performance hall. Here is the sound stage, the big one, and a series of smaller ones down here. Extremely successful, probably unique, certainly unique in North America. And there can't be many like this in the world. It's also separated. You see the area expressed in yellow here. These are the mechanical rooms. And they are unusually all contained in one end of the building and separated structurally and acoustically from the rest of the complex. So you don't get the kind of noise that we're hearing here, the sibilant sound of air coming through different kinds of ducts and louvers. There's very little, if any, vibration. It's in many ways an idealized environment for performance. Very, very successful. That's the dean. Don McLean was dean when the building was built, but he's the first to acknowledge when he talks about this project that he was, I think, the last in a series of four deans who were involved in putting this project together. And I think it's also fair to say that the role of deans in this exercise is extremely important. The role of a dean like Don McLean, before him John Brew, Rick Lawton, the relationships they develop with the project groups and the architects are instrumental in the development of successful projects. You'll see another one in a minute. These are photographs, not of a site, not of a film set for The Name of the Rose, but this is the mechanical space in the back of the Schulich Music Building. It's one of the great spaces of the university, just not that accessible. Computer images of the lobby, image on Aylmer Street looking at the performance hall. We're actually in the performance hall here, and here are the architects, Anik Schooner and Gilles Saussier, giving us live presentation on the building. So this is the outside view of the room that we're in here. And then I think, I don't know if this will work. No, it didn't. This was an animation prepared by Saussier as the building was being put together for fundraising and exploratory purposes. A wonderful sense of what's going on. 1%. Marie-France Briere is the artist. It's called Owned Wave, and again was inspired by the program of the building and executed by her husband, Claude Bernard, who's done a lot of work for us on campus. Close-ups of a marvelous piece. One of the most successful, I think, of the 1% interventions on campus. Back very quickly to another project by Saussier and Perrot. In the Marianopolis, on the Marianopolis site, or the Powell Building site. And you see here a proposal on this site here for a building for the Faculty of Arts. At the time, the building was 150,000 square feet, the budget was 30 million. And it's a nice example of the sorts of issues that facilities and planning deal with on a regular basis. An opportunity arises for a feasibility study. A good architect is mandated to explore. And out of it came what would have been, I think, a very, very successful, very, very interesting project, but we've moved on. Arts has been accommodated in other parts of the university, and that site is now being looked at for other purposes, bioengineering being the most important. The law building, I think we're almost done. The law building opened in 1996, 1997, the Gilbert Law Library here by architect Van Hanganu. You see the context, Chancellor Day Hall, McIntyre in the background, and here just one corner of a facade that many of you may find a little puzzling, this one. I was certainly puzzled, and when I asked the architect about the triangle, he shrugged and said, you know, he's like that sometimes. He's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. He's one of the few Canadian architects with a truly international reputation. And I never really understood the space until I went inside. The two-story study space, which again is one of the university's great spaces. And inside, the shape of the window is no longer an issue. It actually makes sense. It fits. And I would say that this building is one, like many of Hanganu's buildings, that is conceived from the inside out. This is an image I took just the other night. I take a shortcut behind the building. I jump the wall to get into the McIntyre Medical Garage. And I'm exposed every time to this marvelous, almost cross-sectional view of the building's lobby with this. It's a staircase, but it's also a kind of installation which takes us from the main floor up to the top floor. Go into the building, and you see at one point in the lobby, you find yourself visually connected with almost all of the buildings that the Faculty of Law occupies on this campus. It's a very subtle, but a very powerful idea. And these are some of Dan's images. This is part of the atrium that connects, it was part of this project, but it's a space that connects old Chancellor Day Hall with new Chancellor Day Hall. And whenever I see this in other spaces like it, I think of this citation by Louis Kahn, who says, every time a student walks past a really urgent, expressive piece of architecture that belongs to his college, it can help reassure him that he does have that mind, does have that soul. So for me, that's an expression of why we have to reach, why we have to set these kinds of standards. Tomlinson Square, we're going to cut across the reservoir. John Dealey's favorite building. Not from the outside, but from the inside, I think you confessed earlier. The new Genome Building. Strathcona Anatomy and Dentistry. 1907, 1908, Brown and Valence were the architects. It replaced a building that was destroyed by fire. But look at this. That's from the Royal Victoria Hospital. Photograph taken at that time. What you're thinking is this. This was a skylight. How many of you know the octagonal atrium lined with terracotta in that building? Well, that space was naturally lit with a skylight. So did you bring your collection box for donations to restore the skylight later on, Bob? No. Strathcona is up there. Tomlinson Square was here. It's the first time in recent history that the university said it's not about two projects, Trottier Building, the Genome Building, it's about three projects. It was an idea suggested by Marianne McKenna, one of the architects of this building, Kulabara Payne McKenna Blumberg with Fishton Seufman Architects. She said, let's make the square in between a third project. The university hired Morosi and Troy and Shem Landscape Architects. Morosi and Troy were the architects of the Trottier Building on the other side, with Jobin Lamar Pratt. A couple of images of that space. The square first. It's the university's first experience with a new kind of landscape. It was our first experience with taking a piece of the campus that had been occupied by cars and parking and designating as a pedestrian zone. The first time the university did that in recent history. This is all about wild grasses, which will change over time. They compete, like professors looking for grants, departments looking for hiring positions. Looking north towards Strathcona, one of the issues here, of course, had to do with the proximity of both buildings to the heritage project. The rationale at the time was to accept it as an exploration of a kind of urban condition. The buildings were pushed away, and the space in between the buildings was actually very, very thoughtfully put together by both sets of architects. That's some of the master planning group making their way through the landscape by Sherman, Rossi, and Troy up to Strathcona. The Trottier Building itself, like the Genome Building, coincidentally, they're both about 85,000, 90,000 square feet. They're both six stories. They're both on a very complex site in that they're entered on three levels in each case, two levels in the case of Genome, three levels in the case of Trottier, like the Leacock Building. These are buildings. This is a building with three main floors, which both complicates the mandate for the architect, but also provides some very interesting opportunities. In both cases, the upper three floors are expressed differently from the lower three floors as well. Trottier is another building that presents one face to the city, one face to the campus. This is the view from Prince Arthur up the flight of steps towards the link between the Long Building and the Genome there, up University. There's the Genome seen by the entrance to Trottier here. Looking back down from Pine through the space between Strathcona and the two new buildings. The facade facing west here is basically characterized by a series of brise soleil. These are glass panels with a ceramic pattern baked onto it that protects space behind from the direct sun. It's a close-up of that. It changes under different conditions of light. From the inside, it's actually quite transparent, and when we back up a little bit, when we move away from the wall a little bit, we find that behind that layer of sunscreen is a new kind of university space. These are so-called breakout rooms of different sizes. So this building became a very interesting experiment in the development of three or four different kinds of learning space. The kind of thing that Jack Diamond, when he did the master plan, reminded us used to be a part of every program in the 60s and 70s, but it's an idea, he said, that we seem to have lost as budgets became tighter and the rules of the game giving became much less forgiving. So in this case, we were able to, with funding from Lord Croce and others, the university was able to restore or to bring back onto the campus this experiment in different kinds of informal space. And we moved from the so-called breakout rooms here to a kind of transitional space, first come, first served, to open labs, to conventional classrooms. This is another example of 1%. There was government funding. This is a piece by Pierre Leclerc. And there's an unmistakable reference to the concept of the hexadecimal, which he executes in colored glass. He's an architect, by the way, Pierre Leclerc, although most of his practice is based in these installations. Troche, like many new buildings, also goes to great lengths to connect the interior experience to the exterior context. This is actually a view from one of the men's washrooms, which is great, from the stairwell, and then from a stairwell looking back towards Strathcona, which does a great deal, actually, to mitigate the issue of scale. Moving across the square, genome and proteomics, Kuhlbauer, Payne, McKenna, Blumberg, with Fishman, Seuferman, a little larger, but organized in similar ways. You smell the coffee as soon as you walk in. This was a very important idea, and it was an idea behind much of the thinking in Croce when it was in development. It's a two-level, really a three-level lobby. As we go from here up to Pine, which is this entrance here, a reception desk behind a thin sheet of onyx, and then up to a third-level lobby, which is one of the university's most sophisticated modern spaces. Now, if you haven't been there, you must go. It's entirely accessible. Outside, when we go through that lobby on Pine, we find ourselves basically connecting with Royal Victoria Hospital and the mountain. That's the university facade. And once again, a building that presents a very different face to the city. In this case, the face is defined by a series of alternating planes at an angle, introducing a material which nobody in the room, nobody in our room, nobody in this room had seen before, although I've since learned that it's much more common in Europe. But basically what they did was, these lit the offices, open area offices here, private offices behind here, and what they were trying to do was to express that collection of three levels, three floors, as I said before, as a single element. And they didn't want the scale of this compromised too obviously by the punctuation we associate with windows. So they said, is it possible to put a kind of a screen in front that doesn't change this in any material way, but changes the way we think about it? And the material itself is a very fine woven stainless steel mesh stretched on a frame 3 or 4 inches away from the actual wall itself. Now, many of you are thinking, how do you clean that? How do we clean it, Bob? It doesn't get clean, not yet. Well, high pressure, no, we can't use that. No, we'll figure out a way. What's interesting here is that under certain conditions of light, the material becomes less opaque, and we see here the reflected sky. Looking closer, that's what it looks like, and right up a few inches away, it is literally a woven mesh, and you can stretch it. You can push against it, and it has a little bit of give to it. This is what's interesting about the material itself, that under some conditions, it's relatively transparent. I can see through it, and I can see the window, and of course, at night, we can see clearly. Under other conditions, the entire screen reflects the light, and we have no sense at all of what's going on behind. So the fact that the building enjoys this sort of dynamic relationship with the observer is an interesting idea. But how do you explain this? What's going on here? What's with the tiger striping that we're seeing there? Did I hear someone say it? What? Moiré, exactly. But doesn't moiré need two layers of material? Moiré is based, you can do this with fly screen at home, but be careful. Take two bits of fly screen, line them up, and then move them, and you see the patterns. But how do we see the moiré here with only one pattern, with only one layer? How do you explain that? What's that? It's the shadow. At least that's my theory. Not everybody agrees, but I'm glad somebody else made the suggestion and not me. I think it is the shadow. because you don't see it, of course, in overcast days. You don't see it under, even on sunny days, if the sun is at the wrong angle. But when the sun's at the right angle, what you're seeing, I think, is the mesh of the screen interacting with the mesh expressed by the shadow slightly behind. Very slight differences as we move around, and the result is a changing pattern. I photographed this, sent it to the architects, and said, did you know about this? Did you know this was going to happen? And they said, yeah, of course. yeah, we expected that, they said. On the inside, one of the university's great staircases, once again, two layers of the same, in this case, there are two layers of the stainless steel mesh. In this case, you do see the moiré expressed, I think, a little more coherently. You know, from your experience on campus, in some cases it goes back over 40 years, right, Dave? Yeah. When architects come to work on campus, and Michael had this experience as well, they're told very early on that they have a lot of maneuvering room. Michael, you're also responsible for the bookstore, in addition to a lot of work at the gymnasium as well as the stadium. So you're a veteran of these conversations where you're told you can really work with any color you want as long as it's gray, as long as it's the natural color of either concrete or aluminum or a limestone that's as close as possible to the limestone that we find on the main campus. Otherwise, you have a free hand. Right? They understood, as many architects do now, that in fact we operate both day and night. The experience of some of us and some students may even be more associated with darkness than with daylight. And of course, on the inside, painting a wall red proved to be a very effective way of bringing color out into the city. So full credit to them for coming up with that. This is the upper lobby, the bottom of those upper three lab floors. What you're seeing here projected on the inside is another terrific conference room, which we see on the outside here, projecting like a bay and reflecting the city beyond, which makes an interesting reference, John, to one of the lounges in the Wong building, which also projects. You can we'll add it afterwards. And those windows, or those projecting bays, the idea that a public space in the building animates the facade in the ways that those do, brings us back in a very interesting way, I think, to the bay windows by Brown and Valence on Strathcona from 100 years earlier. Not the same kind of function, but there is a similar kind of spirit, I think, at play there. And finally, I want to close with a few images and a few words about James Square. I don't think I've ever been prouder of the university's ability to change the way it thinks about the way we design and build than in the course of this project. For me, and for all of us involved, Jim, Morty, I think you were involved at one time, Bob, a lot of you are in the room. It has been an experience, I think, which redefines for not just those of us involved, but for the entire community, what the campus can be like. You remember what it was like beforehand? Actually, some of you don't. This was actually a very elegantly conceived and executed flight of steps designed by Harold Spence Sales, an architect and planner who taught for many years at McGill. That's what it was like. And more recently, we saw the infrastructure beginning to deteriorate a little bit at a time when the serious infrastructure, those tunnels underneath, called out for replacement. And the opportunity was seized, basically, to redefine the mission or vision of that whole space. From the very start of the exercise, and I'm going to show you very quickly the schemes that were not built. Four schemes that the designers, Williams, Asselin, Akoui, a very interesting group of architects and landscape architects, primarily landscape architects. From the very beginning, the mandate was clear that it's not about dealing with the shape defined by the roadway. And don't forget, this started 2 or 3 years before the idea of a car-free campus was seen as an imminent possibility. But when they started, it was very simple, that the space is defined by the facades of the buildings and beyond, not by the synthetic line described or expressed by the edge of the roadway. So from the very beginning, it was seen as a room, as a separate and finite space. This is one scheme, very similar to what was built, but as architects and landscape architects do in exercises like this, sometimes you have to play devil's advocate to understand what it is you're dealing with, to explore other options. This was another scheme. Some of the schemes replaced the retaining wall. Some didn't. Different kind of scheme. They're using imagery to describe different ideas about landscape. Another, introducing sculpture here and the idea of a kind of amphitheater. And finally, the scheme that was built. And I think if you look carefully, if you spend a little more time with it, you can see more clearly that there are lines that are continuous, ideas that are continuous in each one of those iterations. So that's what was finally built, more or less. We did, as we often do in the School of Architecture, an exercise with students, in this case first-year students, where we challenged them, while the square was actually under construction, to imagine their solutions to the scheme. These were students in a first-year design class in the School of Architecture. They're not landscape architects. They're architects or architecture students. But the issues, I think, are issues that that cross the line between those disciplines. So here we ended up with 50 or 55 individual visions expressed in cardboard and wood of what that square could be like. Vice Principal Francois Roy saw them. Jim, I think you saw them as well. A number of others. Here was one. Here was one inspired by Arthur Erickson's Stramp, a combination of staircase and ramp at Robson Square in Vancouver. He said, couldn't the whole square be developed as a kind of urban, hard surface urban environment with a combination of stairs and ramps? That was one. I'm only showing you three or four out of the 55. This was another one who saw the opportunity to move away from the rectilinear or deterministic geometry of the surroundings and said, couldn't we introduce other kinds of ideas? This was one that combined, she said, she likes the rectilinear nature of the space as defined by the adjacent buildings, and she said, couldn't we celebrate that with a series of terraces, different kinds of plantings, different kinds of environments? And she said, let's program the space. Let's imagine how it could be programmed. As built, you know that there's an amphitheater there, and we will see over time, I think, some very adventurous, some very imaginative programming uses for that space. She said, for example, how about a chess set? The question that follows is, well, what kind of pieces do you use? Well, she said, they've got to be life size or like this. Are you going to use traditional? Are you going to go back to Persian origin? Have you seen the Simpsons chess set? I mean, as a design exercise, chess sets alone can be quite interesting. Almost done. She said, no, let's. she had another proposition. For the pieces, Morty left too soon. So these are the main pieces: the rook, two rooks, two knights, two bishops, the king and the queen. Of course, you're thinking, well, what about the pawns? Well, isn't it obvious? The pawns take care of themselves. So finally, this is what we ended up with. I took this photograph just the other day. It's a cool day. It's still being used. We noticed, in fact, the emails. Images were flying around the campus. Students occupied the space when the construction work was still underway. The minute the stairs were open, we could see the space being occupied in ways here, here, and here that we hadn't even, or that the designers hadn't even imagined, but which, of course, accommodated. Another view, it was Francois Roy who suggested that this would be a great opportunity to concentrate some of the university's sculpture collection. There was one piece there, which you'll recognize when you see it. So we brought this piece, Exaltation by John Porretta. You see it there? From its original location behind the Redpath Museum. This piece, Square Forms and Circles by Dame Barbara Hepworth, is located here from its original spot on one of the landings of the original staircase. This piece, which was a great place to lock bicycles outside the Faculty of Law. That was temporary, the bicycle stand, I should say. A wonderful piece, Polyped by Charles Dodelin, was relocated from New Chancellor Day Hall to its final location in that little terrace in front of the James entrance. So the space now becomes animated in really very, very exciting ways. And this space, this piece here by Marcel Barbeau, which was actually designed for the campus, but not for this site. This was his second or third choice of site at the time, and his preferred choice was actually in this space. So we were able to restore a piece designed by Barbeau for the campus, but intended for this site with his assistance, which was a very interesting experience. You'll be pleased to know that that Victoria, the Falcon, and Big Bronze Gym will not be moving from their present locations. And I think that wraps it up. I knew I would run over a little bit.
Thank you very much, David. Thanks to you all. Thank you all for coming, too. Incredible with the webcast people.